Now, where did I put it? Here it is.
Welcome to the Toolbox, where my guests and I discuss the tools they use every day to manage life, trauma, and everything in between. It may not be applicable right now, but it's another tool for your toolbox. And I hope you enjoy. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Tools for the Toolbox. I am Chance Burles, also known as Big Bird, another little moniker I picked up while jumping out of planes. And I have another outstanding guest for you all today, coming from all the way down in Texas. We'll get this started the same way I do it with everybody else. Who are you? And give me a little bit about your background.
So my name is Yehuda Reamer, and I have a brand called the Pew Pew Jew. I'm an Orthodox Jew. Exactly. I'm an Orthodox Jew who grew up in Los Angeles, lived there for 30 years, got smart enough to move the hell out about 8 years ago, living in the golden state of Texas that I absolutely love. I write children's books on firearm safety, firearms education, history of the two-way. Hell, I even have 105 explosive gun jokes. Yeah, like a literal joke book. So, yeah, I mean, I've been in the industry for about 5 years with all my work. I do firearms instructing here in Texas. And I call out Jews who are anti-gun. So that's kind of like the real shortened version. Yeah, we're talking about like the super abridged version.
So, well, what brought you to this realm? Like, I mean, if you're talking about the two-way realm down in the States and Canada, we don't really have it, but
right,
firearms are a interesting topic up here in Canada. But what led you down the road to get into this field?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first time I bought a gun, it was a Glock 19 Gen 3. It was my first gun. And I kind of kept the idea. I kept it from my parents. Even though I was married, I had two kids, I was living in an apartment. But I didn't tell my parents that I owned a firearm. And one night we were by my parents' house and my younger brother was like, "Hey man, when we could go shoot your gun?" And, you know, and my parents, you know, full on Chernobyl meltdown, right? Like total nuclear meltdown. And they didn't talk to me for weeks. And when they finally did, it was, you know, how can you bring firearms into the home? It's, you're irresponsible. Someone's going to get killed. You know, stuff we've all heard numerous times before. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking that as much as my parents are crazy, that they're wrong, you know, as a firearms owner and with two kids in the house, I need to take firearm safety incredibly seriously. And I need to educate my children so they know what to do. So I went to the NRA's website, found the Eddie Eagle program. And I found myself going through their materials and realizing like, hey, whoa, there is so much more to gun safety than what to do if you find a gun somewhere it's not supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So one night I went to my synagogue for prayers and the rabbi was speaking and really didn't like this rabbi, so didn't care what he had to say. And here I was, I pulled out my phone on my Apple Notes and I wrote my first book called Safety On, which is an introduction to the world of firearms for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wrote it for fun. I never thought, let me take a step back. After I looked at the NRA's website, I went to Amazon to go buy a book for my kids. And I was shocked that there were no books on the market, zero, on gun safety for kids. Again, there's books out there for parents on how to talk about gun safety, but there was nothing for children specifically. So like I said, you know, I wrote the first, my first book on my phone. I emailed it to a buddy of mine who was in the Los Angeles Police Department. He called me up and he said, your book sucks because you got the information wrong, but I'm going to walk you through this because this is a book that needs to get done.
Awesome.
And yeah, and it took me about 5.5-6 years to get my first book published. No literary agent or publishing company really wanted to touch a book that's pro kids, pro guns, Especially no one, especially with someone who doesn't have a following, didn't really have a social media presence, because I was never really big into social media beforehand. So, no one was like, "You're a scrub. No one's nothing. It's never going to happen." I had a lot of detractors telling me, "Don't do it. The book is not going to succeed," or, "Don't get into the firearms industry. It's a bunch of good old redneck KKK members, and they're going to be anti-Semitic." And I'm like, "You know what? Screw you all. I'm going to get this book published one way or another. And you know what? If I deal with anti-Semitism, then I'll deal with it. Let's see how it goes." And finally, in about 2017, January of 2017, I found a small publisher. A few weeks later, book was out. I'd published my first book, and I got some really big names right off the bat to endorse the book. Alan West, Alan Gottlieb from the Second Amendment Foundation, Masad Ayoub, Rob Pincus. And some other really big instructors who were all saying, "Well, this book is amazing. We've never seen anything like it." And one thing led to another. And I never thought that, I didn't think it was going to be successful even after I got it published. But the next thing I know, Alan Gottlieb is like, "Hey, we put on the gun rights policy conference every year. Do you want to speak?" And like at that time, I mean, this was like 4 months after my book came out. At that time, I still knew like nobody in the firearms industry, and on top of all that, I'd always hated being center of attention. I'm a behind the scenes guy, and I hated public speaking, like really detested it. And I, you know, I'm here's Alan Gottlieb, a huge name that I researched and found out, and he's like, "Yeah, sure, I'll speak at that." And then I turned to him like, "By the way, what is the GRPC?" He's like, "Oh, the Gun Rights Policy Coalition." Sorry, Gun Rights Policy Convention. And then I'm like, "Oh, also, by the way, how many people usually come to this thing? I'm thinking what, like, it's a gun rights conference, like 30, right?" He's like, "Oh, I don't know, between 350 and 500, depending on the year." And I went home and I walk into the house, and my wife is like, "Your face is white. What happened?" And I told her, and my wife, being incredibly supportive as she is through her whole ordeal, was like, "Well, suck it up. You said you're going to do it." And she walks away. And I'm like, "Wow, thank you for the moral support, So that's kind of how I fell into the two-way advocacy side. I started off just writing a children's book, and then all of a sudden I gave this speech at the Gun Rights Policy Conference. The next thing I know, I was being called left and right for podcasts and radio. "Oh, we have children's gun safety expert." I'm like, "No, don't." I'm like, "No, I'm just a normal dude who wrote a book for his little kids, and I'm far from being an expert." But over time, I've talked to instructors, I've talked to safety advocates, and would I call myself an expert now? Probably not. But a lot of people would. So,
Well, you know what you're talking about. That's
yeah, pretty
really what
much.
it comes down to, right? So how many books you've written now though? Like, 'cause you have four, five, six?
Is this podcast video or just audio?
It's video.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Eight. Okay. So yeah, I think I only knew about five or six of them. I haven't gotten them yet, but they look really cool. Like, how does it differ from like kids gun safety? How does it differ from normal gun safety? Is it just the wording? Is it like, how do you break that down?
It's really wording. I mean, there's no just the four cardinal rules are the four cardinal rules, right? Your those don't change. What to do if you find a gun somewhere, it's not to be, doesn't change. Having a healthy respect for the firearms, making sure they're clean, making, if you, it's, I know a lot of people that don't necessarily lock up their firearms. If you do lock up your firearms, just having a respect for a firearm, right, as a tool. So I just do it. My books, well, not all of my books are kids' books, but the kids' books aspects of my books are written in a way that kids 6 to 10 can read. As Sweet. My wife says, that you are a stupid baby, so it was very easy for you to write kids' books. I make it sound like my wife is so like not supportive and stuff. My wife is amazing. She has been my right hand on this journey since I launched the Pew Pew Jew, and the amount of support that she has given me is just there's not enough I can do for her in this lifetime that would equal up her support. So, but she's brutal, you know. She's like yeah.
That's a good partner should be though.
Oh, right? Absolutely, like, absolutely.
So there are so many things that I would have screwed up royally had it not been for my wife going, "Are you sure about that?"
Oh, so my wife isn't even, "Are you sure about that?" I'll like run an idea by her, and she's like, "You're an idiot. Don't do that. That's stupid." And I'm like, "Thanks, honey." You know, or she'll just make a face, right? She gives me the same face of "Don't do that" that she'll give to my kids when they're about to do something bad.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, like my 1 year old will like go to the bookshelf and she'll just be like, you know, mm-hmm. and I'll be like, "Hey, I just have that idea. What do you think of it?" And she goes, "Right, it's like the same face, right?" So. No, but I love her. She truly is my rock, and I couldn't do any of this without her. But yeah, like I said, I have let's see how many kids books I have. So I have that one is 105 explosive gun jokes. Technically, it's for kids, but I'm finding more super corny dads are buying it for themselves.
I was gonna say it's probably full of dad jokes because really that's the best jokes ever.
It's great, and it's so funny to see some of the reviews saying like, these jokes are so stupid, and literally if you go to Amazon and look at the description of the book, it literally says the ultimate corny dad joke book. Like, there's jokes in it. Like, and this one I'm so proud of because my son's 13, but he came up with this joke himself that made it into the book when he was 9. It's like, why do revolver shooters hate parks? Because they have slides, right? Horrible. You know, like what's a gun's favorite food at a party?
What?
Guacamole, right? Like just right jokes that you're. I think the only joke that I came up with that I truly burst out laughing, like really was actually that was a funny one. Was why didn't the college grad tell her parents how she paid for school?
Why?
She was field stripping for money. Oh, man. Right? Like that was like the only one that like when me and my partner wrote it, we both looked at each other and we're like, "Oh, that's actually funny." You know, we're like, maybe we shouldn't put this one in the book because it really is a good joke. Yeah, it's the ultimate corny dad joke book, all gun related, 105 gun jokes. Yeah. I would say about 98% of them are original jokes. The other like 2% are like random ones we found like on the subreddit, like
right.
You know. But I mean we would have loved to give props to the ones who wrote those, but obviously there was nothing yeah. to go on. So I have a safety book. I have this book right here is a history of the Second Amendment for children.
Yeah.
This is the safety book version, but sorry, this is the safety book just in coloring book version.
Okay.
And then this one I wrote, it's called 10 Little Liberals. I wrote that when I used to write for Ben Shapiro. This one is the ABCs of guns, which is literally A is for ammunition and the AR-15.
Yeah.
So that's great if your kids are learning the ABCs and you want to do something fun. This one is 10 Little Gun Grabbers. Really pokes fun at, you know, the people trying to take away our Second Amendment rights.
Yeah.
And then my latest book, which came out about a year ago, is this one right here. Called Bullet Points, Reasons Why America Should Embrace Common Sense Gun Law.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we all know common sense gun law is code word for gun control, gun confiscation. So when that book came out, I mean, this is an amazing story.
Yeah.
This is a 220-page book of blank pages. There are no reasons why we should be embracing common sense gun law.
I agree.
So, yes. So I literally came out with a book that has chapter titles, page numbers, headings, footers. I even have a bibliography in the back of the book. And you pick it up and it looks like a real book. Yep. And I knew when that book would come out that I would get a lot of hate from the gun community because, let's be honest, even in our community, 95% of people are like, will judge a book by its cover and be too damn lazy to actually
open it up and research. Read it. Yeah.
So I called, I don't know if you know the Instagram account / Twitter website, Mom at Arms.
I don't know.
You got to check them out. Mom at Arms is single-handedly like taking on Moms Demand Action and Shen Watts, and they are brutal. I mean, they are just, they're like the Firearms Policy Coalition of, you know, taking on Moms Demand Action.
Mm-hmm.
So the head of it, the woman who started it, is a friend of mine named Jill. And I called her up. I'm like, hey, Jill, I'm coming out with this book in a month. I know how brutal you can be. So this is the idea of the book, just so you don't think I'm a turncoat, right? Like, yeah. I'm not throwing the Second Amendment under the bus. And she's like, oh, I'm going to have so much fun with this over the course of the month. She started pumping out articles like every other day that rumors are circulating that the Pew Pew Jew has sold out. He's you know, pro common sense gun law. And she started building up this massive, massive campaign against me to the point where I had instructors that you've heard of, that people that we know met, like high up there in the industry, texting me and calling me like, dude, what is going on? And I actually had to call them and explain to them what my book is. And they were just like, oh my God, we want to be part of this. So they, so all of a sudden this snowball effect started happening of all these people calling me out and hey, you know, we don't really know what the book is, but you know, if it does, if you do come out with a book that's pro common sense gun law, we're gonna drag you through the mud. We are gonna besmirch your name. And like, it was fantastic. And then when the book finally came out, it was just unbelievable because you had some people on the left who bought the book, for example, and then wrote me horrible reviews because they're like, we bought this book and it was blank. And even though on the description also says this book is mostly blank for those that can't take a joke, but people don't read. So I had people on the left getting pissed off at me. I had people on the right, without even looking into the book, calling me a red coat, a Benedict Arnold, a turncoat, everything you can imagine, a traitor that they've been following me for years and they're unfriending me and they're unfollowing me because they can't believe I'm doing it. I'll be like, all right, you're going to feel like an idiot when, you know, you find out. And then the best were some people were like, hey, listen, we know this was your eighth book. We've loved your content for a bunch of years. We bought the book because we trusted you and we wanted to support you. And we figured if you were writing a book about this, maybe you really did have real points that would change her mind. But it reminds me of, but then the reactions when they told me this were all like the same reaction, you know, from Dumb and Dumber, you know, just when they don't think you can do anything stupider, you totally redeem yourself. Right. And like all these people are like, oh my God, we just went in on Amazon. We bought like 9 more copies so we can send them to our anti-gun sister-in-law and my grandpa who's super pro gun. Like it was amazing. The rollout was just phenomenal.
That's so awesome. That actually lends itself to kind of what we want to talk about today anyway, which is like the idea of storytelling and like creating the idea, just the idea, and then sending it out all over the place. is fantastic. I absolutely love that. I wish I had been on board with that, because I would I would also have been on board. I would have been on that in a heartbeat. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
So have you always been a writer, or was it just more like you just kind of dove into it and it's exploded from there? Or like,
no.
How did that come about?
So one thing I'm 100% the black sheep of my family, without question. And one thing I will always credit my parents for, credit for them doing right by me growing up. So when I was 5 years old, my parents actually took away the TV.
Okay.
They said no more TV in the home. We had a TV. We weren't able to use it during the week. We were only able to watch movies on the weekend after homework was done. So, but when I was five, I was kind of forced. This was like 89, right?
We
didn't have, you know, you were only the rich kids had those old school Game Boys, right?
Like, see if he comes back.
The big gray ones. And yeah. So, are you frozen? Can you hear me? You're frozen, but you can't hear me.
There he is. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. It just, you randomly like disappeared. And
it was funny because like I'm in the middle of talking and then it was like one of those things like right out of a movie. They're like, I'm like, hello? I'm like, anyone? You know, like, I'm like, nope, you're frozen.
What I got was you're the black sheep of your family.
Okay.
And then I think you were about to say you're like my parents, and then I like.
Got it. Okay. So I'll start from I'm the black sheep of the family. So if you have to edit it.
Yeah.
So I'm clearly the black sheep in my family, always have been. But one thing I will definitely credit my parents with is taking away the TV when I was five. It was straight up no more TV during the week. No more TV during the weekend. We were able to rent movies, but only after homework was done.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, this was 89, right? So like,
okay.
No one had games, and you know, only the super rich kid had like the old
the original
school
Nintendo.
The original Game Boy that was like this big and weighed like 95 pounds. So my parents took away the TV, and that kind of forced me to pick up books. And you know, books just, you know, being the black sheep, books were just an escape. It was a transporter to another world, to different worlds, to everywhere that I always wished I can go. And one author in particular, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm horrible like that. That's how I got into writing. I've always been incredibly creative because I was reading. So growing up, I used to write like really, really horrible poems, super, super corny. But, you know, they got me into writing. So
yeah,
definitely growing up without a TV shaped my writing abilities. But again, I never ever thought I would be a published and successful author. That literally was never a thing. I always enjoyed creative writing, but I never thought again that, you know, I'd be successful at it.
Yeah.
So
that's an interesting thing, because when I was young, my parents used to read me really advanced books. When we were like, me and my brother, my sister, I'm the youngest of three. And we got like, when we got bedtime stories, it was like Lord of the Rings and Dune and Jurassic Park, Shogun, like big, right, deep novels that we would have to like continually spend weeks reading rather than just these little snippets of stuff. And that it actually
and
helped us.
And now you're screwed up for that, because Shogun is not a kid-friendly book.
No, it's not. But what it did was it gave us a really advanced reading level, because we were comprehending, like my reading comprehension was extremely high when I was in grade school and I was reading at a post-secondary level. So I know exactly what you mean, right? Like you get that extra step in that direction by maybe sometimes the removal of something. My mom used to take the TV cord and she would cut it in half and then take the plug with her, and so that we couldn't watch TV. And it was like super smart until my brother and I figured out that the cord for the TV was the same as basically most electronics. And we found a toaster in the garbage somewhere, found a cord, cut that off, and then we had one on our own. So
we got clever. No, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I was that kid that, you know, when I was in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, I'd be sitting during recess reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd definitely be playing sports too. I mean, I played sports in high school, but man, there's nothing just like opening a good book and screw Kindles and digital readers. I hate those things. You need to have the smell of those pages. You need to have the ink on your finger. Ah, there's nothing like it.
One of my favorite sounds is like complete silence, right? You're just in complete silence and you have the page turn that.
Yes. Yep.
And like, it's just such a great sound. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. It's awesome. And it does, it really opens. It transports you to worlds that you would never be able to engage in any other way.
Right.
I used to read this really great book series called the Xanth series by an author named Piers Anthony. I don't know if you've ever read any of his stuff. Cool fantasy stuff, right? There's people riding horses and unicorns and dragons and blah, 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 blah. It was just awesome. But what it does is it separates you from the reality of the world. Right, it allows you to step out of that. Do you find that was that a similar feeling for you when you were reading as a kid, or even as you got older? Was it as an escape, or was it more just like the fantasy of it?
So it was more of an escape. Like I said, I was always the black sheep, and I'm also a middle child, so I definitely suffer from middle child syndrome. there's no question about that. But, you know, man, I love this topic because there's that very famous line, you are what you eat, right? But I've kind of crossed that over to you are what you read.
Yeah.
And my favorite author growing up, I started reading him in sixth grade when he had like 12 or 13 books. Now he's got like 80 books. Clive Cussler.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. But he has one of his books were made into a movie that they butchered with Matthew McConaughey called Sahara. And the character, at least in the original, he has like five different series, but the original character is a guy named Dirk Pitt. And Dirk Pitt was the type of guy who was the perfect chivalrous knight, if you will. But again, it takes place in modern times.
Yeah,
he was Indiana Jones meets James Bond meets freaking John Wick, right? Like this guy was just, he was able to wine and dine his beautiful girlfriend at night, but then during the day he was diving on shipwrecks and saving the world from egomaniac people, and his, but his books were all about, all dealt with water. So growing up, I always wanted to be, I mean, this is kind of like a little, not a lot of people know about me, but my dream job growing up was to be a marine archaeologist. I love being on the water. I love being under the water. I've done scuba diving. And this character was just pure, let's call it toxic masculinity, right? Like just pure masculine. And, you know, there was no gray zone with him, right? The character Dirk Pitt, there was either good and evil. And what I liked about the books also is every bad guy in all of his like 80 books that he has. Unfortunately, Clive Cussler just passed away about 2 years ago. Okay. He was in his 90s. But all of the bad guys in his books, there was no troubled bad guy, right? It wasn't like, oh, I'm being pulled for the good. It's like, no. You had the good guys who were good, and you had the bad guys who were evil. End of story. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm being torn. Do I do the right thing? Do I not? No, I'm going to go with the B. Like, it wasn't like that. And that's what I loved about his books. And he was probably the biggest influence on my writing career. Not only because I read and I still continue to read. You know, some people have taken over his writing since he's passed. But I still read him. But when I was 19. When I was 19, I actually wrote a 120-page movie script.
No.
And I sent it to Clive Cussler thinking, you know, why not? Well, doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
And I remember about 6 weeks after I sent it to him, I get a letter in the mail from, you know, return address with Clive Cussler. And I was absolutely terrified to open this because here is like not just an author that I love, but here is someone who's written so many books who, again, I started reading him when I was in sixth grade. So we're talking about I was 12. Now I'm 18, right? So over the course of like 6 years, truly has shaped my life, really shaped my life and my personality. I wanted to be this character that he wrote about. So I was terrified that his letter back to me would be just one of those moments where your hero writes back to you and you're like, and it's just like, thanks for the support. That's it.
Yeah.
This page right here is 8 paragraphs. He wrote back to me. 8 paragraphs. And it's completely custom because he actually dissected my screenplay.
So not only did he write back, but he read it and wanted to give you points. Yeah, that's awesome.
And he critiqued it, but nowhere. No, I mean, like literally the last line is, where was it? When Raise the Titanic became a bestseller and I could finally write full time. People used to tell me, congratulations on your overnight success. He goes, my answer? Yeah, 11 years.
Yeah.
And like his letter to me was just like, you know what? I don't care how many books he comes out with. I will never, ever stop reading him. And like I said, he's influenced my personality, my writing. He has just been, I mean, he was, like I said, just a complete advisor, if you will, on my life. And I know we talked about it, right? And like that's just reading for me is so therapeutic.
Yeah. So how do you find that like you read more when you get into a stressful situation, or does it like, or is it more of a reactionary thing of like, you know, my life's going all over the place right now, I need a few minutes to go sit down and read? Or is it more everyday kind of maintenance kind of deal?
It's kind of, I mean, I also have 4 kids, you know, from ages 1 to 13. So
yeah,
I don't have the same amount of time that I wish I had. God I have my my Sabbath, because you know, with my Sabbath, there's no electronics. I can just shut down. So when my kids go to bed or if they're playing upstairs, I can actually sit down, ignore my wife, and keep on reading.
Yeah.
But you know, one thing that I do find myself doing besides reading is putting on some noise canceling headphones, just kind of getting into bed, you know, showering maybe early, earlier in the evening, like getting into bed. And then I love movie scores. Like I absolutely love movie scores. So I'll just put them on and just close my eyes and lie down in bed. And that is just, it calms my entire body down. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's actually quite interesting. I found the the way not only music or but reading, just basically the use of your subconscious, I guess, really, because you can actively read something, but there's a different feeling to when you're just reading and time just kind of passes. And similar with music too. I used to use Gregorian chanting. Actually, was really cool. And that's what I'd like to fall asleep to. So I usually had music going as I was falling asleep. And I went to basic training, and I would hook up my phone and I'd have the music playing. It would be like super low, and the guys next to me could hear it, but they were like, oh, whatever, that's fine by me. And then I think a couple other people had heard it when they were walking past my bed, and they were like, oh, that's pretty good. Can you turn that up? So at one point I had it like up on the walls of my, my little cubicle in basic training. And I like turned the volume right up, and we'd be listening to Gregorian chanting as everyone was falling asleep and stuff. And, I got woken up by a drill sergeant real fast after, I think after that one, and he was just like, what the fuck is that? Get it off. No. And I was doing pushups in the middle of the night. It was good times. But you know, the ability to, you know, kind of shut down the forebrain, right? To be able to just shut that down and experience music or experience the book or, I don't know, it's like an emotional, you get to tap into something emotional. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, between my books, and I'm very picky with what I read. I'm not one of these people. Everyone's like, oh, you should read James Patterson. This, I'm like, don't care. Don't care about those people. So, you know, right now there's like 3 fictional authors I read. Four fictional authors I read. And that's about it. Most of the other stuff is historic or, like I said, I'm very into politics, so I'll read stuff like that. Cool thing is though, my favorite author, really, he became my favorite author of all time. I've actually become friends with him. We've never met officially, but we talk all the time via email, Stephen Pressfield.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. Are you familiar with Stephen Pressfield?
Kind of. I recognize the name basically, but I.
So he has a very famous book called The War of Art.
Okay.
Instead of The Art of War, The War of Art. You know, anyone who is like one of these like TED Talk billionaire gurus will all say that like that's in their top 10 that everyone has to read.
Yeah.
He has a great book called Gates of Fire. I'm sorry. That is a dramatization of the Battle of Thermopylae. Mm-hmm. And he writes a lot about the warrior mentality and overcoming obstacles. And so he's my favorite author of all time at this point. Yeah. I own every single one of his books. I actually helped him out with some stuff, and all these books right here are all signed copies of books from him.
Sweet.
Oh yeah, it was awesome. I helped them with something super small, and then like 2 weeks later, I get like this like 80-pound box, and it's like, oh, I know you said you liked, I know you know this is your favorite book, and blah blah blah. So here is a bunch of signed copies, and what he did is so cool. I was literally like a 14-year-old girl at a Justin Bieber concert. I was so giddy. My wife was making so much fun of me. He actually, not only did he inscribe each book, but he actually wrote a different inscription for each book. So, and it was catered to me. It wasn't like, oh, thanks for everything. Or, you know, or it was like literally things that he knew about me that he, so it was awesome. So he is someone that I absolutely love. And his books, if your listeners out there are not familiar with Stephen Pressfield, I cannot even begin to tell you how life-changing his books are.
I'm gonna dive in there right now, actually, as soon as we're done here. I remember being told about the War of Art. War of Art or On Art?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Yeah.
The War of Art.
Yeah. Of Art. Yeah, okay. I remember being told about that, and I just haven't put it in my collection yet, but it's going in there today.
Yeah, definitely. I'll tell you, definitely read that one. I mean, I know you're a veteran, so anyone who's a veteran, The Gates of Fire is unbelievable. The Battle of Thermopylae and the 300. And then he has another book. I mean, all of his books are amazing, but he has one book which, after reading it, immediately went into my top five of all time, called, oh, of course, right when you need to know, I see the cover.
God.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's like, every time.
Favorite book, right? Happens yeah. Every time. okay, hold on.
Good.
This is
while you think about that, the thing I was going to say about this whole thing is that, you know, books are the original remote learning tool, right? It's a way to pass information. And even if it is fictional or nonfiction, whatever, like it allows somebody somewhere else to learn something anywhere.
Right.
Like this is I say all the time that, you know, this particular medium, the fact we can do podcasts, we can do video chats and all these things, it's great. And we can utilize this. And it's something that we've never had as a community before to be able to interact like this. But books were the original, man. That's how you passed on the information.
No, absolutely. Just wait. The book is called The Virtues of War.
Ooh.
And it's the entire story and campaign of Alexander the Great, told from the eyes of Alexander the Great. And what makes it phenomenal is by the end of the book, like, I don't know if you're familiar with the whole story of Alexander the Great and all of his generals. And
yep.
By the end of the book, I would have laid my life down for Alexander the Great, but at the same time, and I'd never had this feeling before, literally, I would have been willing to lay my life down for him, but at the same time, hated him with such a passion. The writing, The Virtues of War, it just mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing. So I highly recommend Gates of Fire, Virtues of War, and The War of Art.
I will pick them up. That sounds like awesome reads. Now, are there like historical fiction, right? They kind of like follow the same thing, but not.
Yeah. I would say half of his books. So he's got a bunch of nonfiction self-help books like The War of Art. He has another one that's been actually making its rounds called Put Your Ass Wherever Your Heart Is, or Wherever Your Heart Wants to Be, which is a great one also. So he's got a couple books like that. But then he has majority of his fictional work is historical fiction. And most of it takes place in Athens, Sparta, some sort of, you know, Greek.
Yeah. Like grand history, something.
Right. And you know, follows the campaigns it's eye opening because it really gives you, again, he touches on real history, right? It's not like. Yeah. Right. Obviously, he doesn't know what the generals were saying, you know, behind Alexander's back. So obviously he fills that in. But the stuff is just fantastic.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend anything Stephen Pressfield writes.
I will jump on that because that I know a lot of guys up here would appreciate that as well. I know a few history buffs that always love a good historical fiction, because I mean, really, also anything about history and writing as a whole is that's the only reason we know about history is because somebody's written it down somewhere, right? And that's a passage of information through time that allows us to, you know, read about something and then, you know, make our interpretation of it. Because, you know, one thing I learned, I was reading Dave Grossman's On Combat while I was in Afghanistan. And
I think I have that right here somewhere on my desk.
It's a great book. I got a couple of copies. I think I usually hand out to people too. But I was reading it, and the information that I was gaining while I was there were reflections of what was happening. Right. So like I got into a firefight. There was this, apparently an RPG went over my head. I don't recall that ever happening. But I went back to the FOB, and while I was like reading, I think 2 or 3 days after, that was like, visual explosion will happen. You know, sometimes this person will, in a critical incident, one person will see something and the other person won't. Right. Even though they're like right beside each other, it just happens that way sometimes. So just being able to have that information and then apply it to me directly in that situation. Sweet. Right.
Yeah.
That helped me so much. So I always love the fact that, you know, history as a whole is told to us because of someone's writing. Someone had sat there and decided to tell the story, and then someone else decided to write that down.
Right.
However it happened, and went from there. Do you have any other, any particular styles of writing when you decide to sit down and write, or do you try to, you know, make it up as you go along? Is it more like your own style, or are you practiced enough to kind of take somebody else?
I think it's more my own style. I fancy myself as a mediocre writer, but I do have an amazing editor who just makes me sound a hell of a lot smarter than I actually am. So she is, like I said, I have a very special place for this woman. She's in the firearms industry too. She's an editor for a massive website, which I'm sure you know of. But she has had my back since my first book came out. So she's awesome. I love her. And she makes me sound much smarter than I actually am.
Okay. That's awesome. Now, would for all the people out there that are looking to write a book, per se, or perhaps, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself when you first started?
Sit your ass down and just do it. You are your own worst enemy. And I know we've heard that numerous times, but when it comes to writing, write one sentence at a time. That's it.
Yeah.
I know you said one piece of advice, but the idea is just, the idea is just do it, right? Like the only person holding you back from writing is yourself. Yeah, you are literally the only person. Right? I was told by so many people, don't write a book on gun safety for children because it's pointless. No one's going to get it.
Yeah.
I have 8 books in 5 years. I have an incredibly successful and recognizable brand in the firearms industry that I've built from the ground up all by myself. I'm still running my entire brand by myself. I don't have anyone helping me. I'm doing it all, and it's all because I sat down and I started writing that first sentence. So, you know, some people will tell you, well, you know, write an outline of what you want in each chapter, which, hey, yes, absolutely do that if that's the type of books you're going to write. I write children's books and blank books. So literally, you know, literally children's books and blank books. So I don't necessarily need to be sitting there and writing 200, 300, 500 words per chapter, if not more. So just sit down and write that first sentence. Because if you don't, you're not going to.
Yeah, that is probably the best advice I've heard for basically anything. I tell this to vets. I tell this to, you know, people that are struggling. Anything that you get to a point where you're like, I don't know if I really don't, just like start, just begin.
Just like, do it, yeah.
That's all it takes. Once you begin, then you can make decisions. Then you can say, well, you know, this is horrible. This is bad. I can't keep this up. But
it's like I said, right? what Stephen Pressfield's book right there, that middle one on the bottom. Mm-hmm. Put your ass where your heart wants to be. It's literally, it's that simple. If you want to become a writer and you want to do it. Now, again, I understand you might get writer's block, whatever. But if you truly want it, sit down in that chair, write that first sentence, and keep on writing. My book was literally turned down. My first book was turned down by over 35 literary agents, 35 publishing companies. I actually eventually found a publishing company after I found an agent. It was going to be a huge publishing company. I was going to get the book out into every bookstore. 3 months after I signed the contract, they canceled the deal. And it sucked. I went into a serious dark place in my life, probably the darkest I've ever been, because it's something I really wanted. But I pushed through and I did it because I wanted it that badly. So sit down. You're going to get bumps along the road, but just write one sentence at a time.
That's it. I got this line from a movie from many years ago. With kids, you might have seen it. It's called Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron.
Great score. Great
score. Beautifully done. Brian Adams like kicked the crap out of that one. He did really well on that. One of the lines from that has always stuck with me, and I love it. It's the colonel who's talking, and he's like, time, patience, and discipline are the three great levelers.
Yep.
And 100% they are, right? If you take enough time with enough patience and you're disciplined, you will achieve whatever it is you want to achieve.
Yeah, look, my next book, I know we talked about it a little earlier, right? But my next book, man, it's the biggest project I've ever undertaken. And I'm talking about literally the biggest project in my life I've ever done. And, you know, I understand that it might take a year, maybe even 2 years to get this project completely finished, which sucks because I only thought about it 2 weeks ago. So I've got that long haul, right? I'm not even like, I'm like so far from even being remote. Like I'm maybe at like 0.5% out of 100% done. Yep. But it's one of those things, right? I'm going to sit there. I'm going to push through. I'm going to be disciplined because this is something that I really want. It could be my most successful book ever.
Yep. I hope it is, because it, like, from what we talked about, it's going to be amazing, at least in my point of view.
Yeah. Like I said, it's nothing that's ever been done before. So it's going to be a very interesting take, and it's going to be a very interesting to see how people react to it. And no, it's not blank, and that's not a joke book. This is actually going to have real words in it and real writing.
Yeah.
So
real English words.
Yeah, real English words. Not for children.
Yeah.
It's
going to be awesome.
I'm actually adulting. So, awesome.
That's going to be great. Now we've been running for a little bit over an hour here. I really appreciate, just wanted to let you know how much I appreciate you being on here. It has been my absolute pleasure. Just learning from you, and there's some great tools for a lot of people here. Are there any last minute points or things that are burning inside of you about storytelling that you want to get off to the world?
No, it's funny. No one's ever asked me that, but one thing I find is when you're writing, and it's one of the reasons why I hate nearly every movie that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
When you're writing and you're like, oh, that'll be really, really funny if we put that in the movie, or that'll be really, really cool. Take a second, look at the world around you. Is it going to be really funny, or is it going to be like cliche, been there, done that? That was very 3 months ago.
Right.
Like, you're writing something now, but it's not going to come out for a while. Is it still going to be something that people will find funny?
Yeah.
And I find people from all walks of life posting these super cliche, super, been there, done that. And you're sitting there and you're like, why would they even put that in there? Like, I just don't get it. Like,
yeah.
And I'm trying to think, there was a movie I just saw that I was actually enjoying, and then they threw in this one thing at the, like towards the end. I'm just like, no, why? You suck. Why? And I'm trying to think what it was. Oh, it was from the new Predator movie. I don't remember the exact scene.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched it. Actually, pretty decent movie.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely worth watching. But there was one thing in the movie, like the whole movie was so gritty, and then there was one thing where you're like, really? You had to, like, come on. No, why would you put that in there? It just doesn't fit with the whole ambiance over the flow of the movie. So, you know, when you're thinking about putting something into whatever you're writing, take that one step back and be like, okay, does it fit with the overall theme? And is it corny? Like, is it just like, you know, do you like, you know what I'm talking about? Like when you watch something and you're like, oh, come on, really?
Yeah, no, seriously.
Stupid. Like, oh, like you guys are getting paid millions of dollars. Why would you put it in like that? Like so many other ways you could have taken, but like, why would you go like super like cliche and like just ruin the flow? So just, you know, anyone who's thinking about writing, just do that, you know?
This happens to me all the time. Anytime I see a movie that has explosives in it, because I was a combat engineer and that's what I dealt with a lot. And it's painful. It's painful when you sit there and like somebody throws a grenade, there's a giant fireball and you're like, mm-hmm. Well, there goes the rest of the movie for me.
Right. So again, so I hear that, but that's more of like a ignorance thing, right? That's more of, right? That's more of like Hollywood being ignorant to the actual, to the reality of a situation.
I don't think it's so much ignorance as so much as it needs to be like
Hollywood-esque,
right? Like there's subject matter experts that are sitting there on the site that are telling people like, this is not how explosives work, but.
Right.
I
hear what you're saying, but I just, and don't get me wrong, when you know, anytime I watch a movie or a TV show and, you know, they're holding the gun, teacupping, I'm just like, no, you're an idiot. You know, like I'm yelling at the TV and my wife's like, stop it. But, you know, I think just when you're watching something that's so good and then they just do something that's, I'll give you a very easy example that everyone's going to know. Think GoldenEye, right?
Yeah.
Great James Bond movie, right?
Yeah.
The movie itself was fantastic, but let's be honest. When he had that scene at the beginning where the airplane jumps off, he jumps off, you know, the cliff. Oh, sorry, the airplane falls off, and he's like skydiving right down, and he gets into the airplane, like. At the time, that might have been cool in like the mid-90s. Yep. And you might even be able to say like, okay, that's cool. But like, you're like, yeah, not really believable. Think today, right?
Yeah.
If my son who's 13 goes back and watches that today, he'll be like, that's just pure crap.
Yeah.
Pure crap. Yeah. So like, that's what I'm saying, right? Like, now I get it. You're doing it for the times necessarily, right? You're not doing it for, you know, for the generations to come. But think about all those movies that you've seen that have lasted the test of time. And none of them have any of these like cliche, corny things where you're like, really? Yeah. You know, I mean, how many times have you seen Blazing Saddles, right? Like probably too many times to count.
Yeah.
But the reason why you can keep going back to it is because there are no cliche, stupid things that are like, oh, no, that's just dumb. Like,
yeah,
it's timeless.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that the points that are like cliche, they're done on purpose to make them funny.
But that, right, exactly.
Yeah.
But 100%. I'm just saying, you know, if anyone wants to like write out there, you know, like my son just had a bar mitzvah this past week and, you know, I made the slideshow.
Yeah.
And as I'm going through the pictures of the slideshow and like, oh, that'll actually be funny. And I put this cool transition in there and it looks awesome. And I'm like, I go back like 30 minutes later and I'm like, okay, gotta, you know, rewatch the slideshow 45 times until, you know, the music syncs up and I'll watch that one scene. I'm like, oh, I broke my cardinal rule. Yeah. I'm like, nope, you're out, because that just made me cringe.
Bye-bye.
Basically, that's what it is. Don't put anything in your writing that you yourself would cringe at in real life. If you read it or saw it and you're like, oh, don't put that in. Think long and hard of whether or not it's worth putting that in.
That's a great point. If you make yourself cringe, don't add it to your writing.
Don't add it. Don't add it. Okay.
So if anybody that isn't following you would like to, where can they find you? How would they find your books? Where would they go to get this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So across social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, especially Instagram, that's where I do a lot of stuff. It's at the Pew Pew Jew. Please don't forget the Pew Pew Jew. You can go to my website, thepewpewjew.com.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel that my signature on a book is worth all of $8, feel free to purchase signed copies on my website. If not, and you want to be cheap, go to Amazon, because they're up there too. And if you need to reach out to me, like I said, I do a lot of Instagram. Is probably Instagram and Twitter are probably the two best ways to reach out to me, or through my website.
Raj, awesome. Well, Yehuda, I can't thank you enough, man. It has been my absolute pleasure just sitting here chatting with you about books, reading and stuff. It has been
been
awesome. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I can't wait to read those books. It's Simon Pressfield, right?
Stephen
Pressfield. I am Stephen horrible Pressfield, with names, yeah. So like I'm really working it just remembering. I'm gonna forget in about 10 seconds.
Just message me. I'll send you to his website.
Raj, perfect. All right, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, man.
That concludes another episode of The Toolbox. I really appreciate y'all listening. It has been my absolute pleasure bringing you this guest. If you enjoyed what you heard, please like, share, subscribe, do all that other wicked stuff. It helps me keep the lights on. To all those out there putting it on the line every day, I just want to let you know that I appreciate you. Military, veterans, first responders, civil servants, you name it, keep this place running, and I really do appreciate it. So thank you. Don't forget, stay open, stay humble, stay focused, with grace, not slack. GMO.